Thank you for calling the Every Little Thing Helpline.
Thank you, Molly, for calling the Every Little Thing Helpline.
Hi, Flora. This is Molly.
Molly had a question about outer space and poultry.
I have a question about space. What would happen if a body was in space? And we don't have to do that to a body. Perhaps we could just toss a chicken breast out of the space station. What would happen when a body was out in the grand open air? I'm dying to know.
Oh, you die. You die.
You die.
Yeah, horribly. Disgustingly. Unpleasantly.
Molly, meet Paul.
I'm an astrophysicist at The Ohio State University.
Why so disgusting and why so horrible? Like, is it worse than drowning or burning?
I think you're asking the right questions. Like, death is the destination, but when you're exposed to a vacuum, a matterless, pressureless void, the story's really about the journey.
Yeah, the journey towards death, exactly.
Don't worry, I mean, we're going to get to every disgusting detail of that journey. But I do want to cover the chicken breast base.
Regrettably, yes.
Tell me about what motivated the chicken breast part of your question.
Part one, probably the wine. The chicken breast didn't need to be there. It's that simple, but there she is, and I'll live with it.
Did you drunk dial us?
Okay, like a tier below drunk, but yeah, okay.
Such a nerdy drunk dial.
I can't help it.
All right, so here's the answer to the chicken breast portion of your question.
To my knowledge, a chicken breast has not been exposed to the vacuum of space, but we have exposed various materials, including chicken breasts, and on accident, sometimes people, to vacuums here on Earth.
Okay.
Molly, there is a human person who has been exposed to the vacuum of space on Earth.
Did they die?
Okay, I got you now. I can hear you well.
No.
Oh.
In fact, we talked to him.
Oh my God, what?
My full name is James C. LeBlanc.
This is Jim. He's very much alive. And he was exposed to a vacuum during a kind of terrifying accident at NASA. So Jim was a spacesuit tester.
That's bold.
So bold.
When was this?
It was December of 66.
And at that time, we knew from the basic laws of physics and sad animal experiments that bad things happen to bodies in space. That's why we have spacesuits. But before those spacesuits go to space, they need to be tested, which means people needed to wear them in a vacuum.
So I thought, hey, that might be pretty neat to do that. So I volunteered for that.
I don't know that I would think that's pretty neat. I think I'd be scared.
Well, I had confidence in all the emergency systems we had in place, and I had real confidence in the engineers and technicians that operated those systems. So we needed somebody to do it, so I stepped in.
That's the best.
And I want to send you a picture of Jim in the suit. I'm going to email it to you right now.
Awesome.
Let me check it. Okay, check it. Oh, wow!
Yeah, that was the exact suit we're talking about here.
The spacesuit kind of just looks like a caricature of what a spacesuit would be. Just super, like, large, puffy, armored.
Yeah, and let me tell you a little bit about this suit. This was the first suit that was designed to be standalone and to be able to walk in it.
And that's because this suit was designed to go to the moon.
Wow.
And you can also see it's covered with these nozzles, which are the life support system. They provide oxygen and they keep the pressure stable in the vacuum of space. So to test it, Jim has to put on the suit, put on the life support backpack, and then walk into a vacuum chamber.
It's an 8-foot diameter chamber and about 25 feet long. And it's basically stainless steel and has a control room on top of it.
So Jim walks through the first door. He's in the outer chamber. There's another observer there. And then he has to walk through another smaller door. He has to crouch to get in. He gets into the inner chamber. The door closes. He's by himself, and the pressure begins to drop. And meanwhile, Jim's job is to step up and down on this little platform to test the ability of the suit to deal with, you know, his exhaling the CO2 and needing more oxygen, whatever.
I stepped up and down for, I don't remember how long. And then I heard a hiss, and I noticed on my left side a spray from the hose. And I could feel the suit starting to depressurize.
Yikes!
At this moment, Jim knew he lost suit pressure, which means he was now exposed to the vacuum. And of course, he tried to say something to the people who were observing.
Of course, I had no air in my lungs, so no words come out. You speak, and there's no air to go by your vocal cords, so you don't even know you're not speaking.
He has no oxygen to breathe. He can't make a sound. And within 12 seconds, he begins to pass out.
I actually fell over backwards and hit the... There was a pass-through in the lock, and I hit my head on that and actually broke the helmet.
In that moment, were you scared?
No, there was no time to to be scared. We were just working through a problem, basically.
How many more seconds would it have taken to have killed you?
12 seconds and you go unconscious. Longer than that, cells in your body start dying. So from that on, it's downhill.
And then the last thing Jim remembers before going unconscious is the saliva on his tongue beginning to bubble off.
That is how life ends, you know?
Luckily, that is not how this story ends. So the engineers and observers around reacted super fast. They repressurized the room, and within a minute, Jim had regained consciousness.
And I came to when the chamber operator called out 14,000 feet, which is about 7.5 PSI. And at that point, I ached all over. And my ears really, inner ears really ached. And I basically was disconnected from the backpack and stood up and walked out.
You walked out.
Yep.
Wow.
Walked out of the chamber. There must have been 150 people standing out there and some applause, whatever. But
I feel like you're downplaying it.
Well, yeah, I was just a member of a team, and it couldn't happen to anybody. So I try not to make a big deal out of it.
He's so cool.
I know. In fact, he was so kind of untraumatized by the whole experience that he went on to test more spacesuits.
I already had my accident.
Jim actually became a test director at NASA. He was part of this team that got us to the moon.
I conducted the chamber test for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in that same chamber, and several others that walked on the moon too.
That's so awesome.
So Jim is partly why we know what happens to a body in space.
I didn't realize that you could lose pressure and it, you know, if it was taken care of quickly enough that you would survive.
Yeah, that's the key. If you're exposed to vacuum, if you're retrieved quickly enough, you can be resuscitated and only suffer minor effects.
So that's Paul again. But what happens if you're not retrieved quickly?
Let's get dark and morbid.
Yes. And I do feel like we need to do a kind of hard reset because I don't want you imagining this charming spacesuit tester, Jim. Like, I want you to imagine someone else so that we can really enjoy the gross details of what happens to a human body in space.
Okay, I think that sounds good.
Get another character in your mind?
You bet I do.
Great. Okay, so what do you think happens?
Okay, I imagine you explode.
I thought that too, because no pressure, things expand.
But we have this thing called skin that keeps our insides on the inside and prevents us from blowing up.
Mythbuster, you would not explode.
No.
Okay, calming.
However, you would expand.
Yeah, this is an effect called ebullism. The fluids in your skin and just underneath your skin do expand a little bit. So you'll inflate like the Michelin Man.
Well, that's not like a little bit of swelling.
Okay, it's a little bit of swelling compared to exploding.
True. Next up, all the liquid on your body, like your sweat, the saliva in your mouth, your tears, would evaporate really fast, again, because of the pressure.
And that rapid phase change is going to damage your skin. So you're going to get, kind of looks like freezer burn.
Ugh.
So imagine like a Michelin Man covered in skin damage. That's you.
Let's be clear. It's not me. I have no plans to go out there. But okay, that's looking terribly grim for sure.
And then what else do you think might be happening?
Would it almost immediately freeze your flesh?
That is exactly what I thought, because it is approaching absolute zero out there, which is really cold.
Yes.
However...
No, you wouldn't freeze right away.
Because the fastest way that you lose heat is by passing it to something else.
Exactly. You need to be immersed in some medium, like air or water.
But in the vacuum of space, there is nothing to pass heat to.
Oh.
So you can still emit infrared radiation, but it takes a lot longer to cool down that way. So basically, you would freeze faster in a freezer.
Yes, exactly. So if you want to freeze a chicken breast, it's smarter to put it in a freezer than in the vacuum of space.
Well, that's convenient.
Okay, so you are chilled but not frozen, bloated, and burned.
But that's not going to hurt you long term. The problem you run into in just around 10 to 20 seconds is that your brain is starved of oxygen.
So before all that chilling and bloating and burning is complete, you are knocked out. And then it's only a couple more minutes before all your organs shut down and you die.
Okay, so from the span of first being ejected to passing out, about how long is that whole ordeal?
It's only 10 seconds until you go unconscious.
The whole thing is 10 seconds.
Yes.
Wow. A lot's going on, though.
A lot is happening. However, I think one could make the argument, and I did make this argument to Paul, that this is not that bad a way to go. In terms of experience, it doesn't seem that horrible.
Well, I don't know your personal preferences for how you might die, so it's hard to say. It's 10 to 20 seconds of pure torture, in panic, and then you pass out.
10 seconds. I mean,
Hey, when your life is on the line, that 10 seconds can feel pretty long. I'm imagining. I'm just at guessing that. You know, somewhere on the scale, it's somewhat worse than just falling, you know, dying in your sleep.
Well, okay, dying in your sleep is the gold standard. Okay,
surrounded
yes,
by your loved
obviously.
Ones or whatever.
But I mean, that's not how most of us go.
But maybe better than being mauled by a bear.
Seems definitely better than that. You're in space. You're taking in this astounding view of the cosmos.
But you're going to be tumbling uncontrollably. So it's going to be wheeling around like crazy. So you won't really get to focus on anything and really soak it in.
You know, yeah, if you're in physical torment, even looking back at Earth, I'm sad to say, I don't think I would sign up.
Thanks, Molly. Drunk dial us anytime.
Awesome. You can count on me.
If you want to see Jim in his spacesuit, we will have it on Facebook and Twitter. After the break, a question about Earth vacuums.
Hi, it's Allison. Okay, so basically I live in an apartment with four other people right now, and my chore is vacuuming. And I just got to thinking the other day, who made a vacuum? Like, have vacuums existed as long as carpet has? Anyway, let me know. I'm very curious.
Catherine Wells, you're going to take this one?
Yeah, I'm going to take the vacuum cleaner question. Thank you, Flora. I called Allison. She's a college student in Longview, Texas. She lives in a group apartment with three other girls, and her chore is to vacuum their wall-to-wall carpeting.
We have this really ugly, like, short purple carpet.
Are you good at vacuuming?
Am I good at vacuuming? The fact that I don't know what that means makes me think the answer is no.
So describe your question.
My question is, how did we clean carpet before vacuum? Was there carpet before vacuums? And who invented the vacuum? Like, why would they invent it if there wasn't carpet? So, like, which came first, the chicken or the egg there?
Exactly. So, it is a classic chicken or egg.
I just don't know why anyone would invent a vacuum if you didn't need a vacuum already. But what were they doing if they didn't have a vacuum already?
Yes. Okay, so let's take this piece by piece. So I'm going to introduce you to someone. His name is Randy Patton. He is a carpet expert.
As much as one could be, I suppose, yes.
That's amazing.
He's a professor of history at Kennesaw State University. And this is what I will tell you first. He's the kind of person who has very strong opinions about carpet.
The old woven carpets were tough old birds. They would wear forever. And the new tufted carpets would crush down and wear out, and they would be ugly as sin, you know, within a few years.
Anyway, so before wall-to-wall carpeting, there were rugs, right? And no vacuum cleaners.
In the old days, people cleaned rugs, you know, smaller rugs, by picking them up. You take them out of the house, hang them over a clothesline in the backyard, and you beat them.
Oh, wow. That sounds tedious.
Okay, but obviously there was room for improvement in the rug cleaning technology area. And so for this part of the history, we're going to a person named Tom Gasco. He is the curator of a vacuum cleaner museum.
What?
In St. James, Missouri.
No.
How robust would you say the vacuum appreciation community is?
Oh, very. There are a lot of vacuum cleaner collectors out there.
Tom loves vacuums really deeply and intensely. He loves vacuums so much that he has a tattoo of a vacuum cleaner logo.
People always say to me, if I'm wearing a t-shirt or something and they happen to see it, they always say, what does that mean?
What do you think they're thinking?
Well, they're thinking this man is crazy. But this man has 650 vacuums. When I tell them that too, then they really think I'm crazy.
Okay, so Tom started repairing vacuums when he was 6 years old.
6 years old.
He can tell the make and model of a vacuum just by its sound.
This machine has a very unique startup when I start the switch. Listen.
That's a Kenmore Commander tank type, for the record. So obviously, Tom is the right person to tell us when the vacuum cleaner was invented. The vacuum cleaner as we know it, the first electric one that was widely available, handheld, push it around, has a bag on it. That one is
1907.
Wow.
So that's when it was invented. But what I really want you to know is who invented it.
Murray Spangler was an asthmatic janitor in a department store in Canton, Ohio.
So he spent a lot of time beating and shaking out rugs, and the dust would just go everywhere and activate his asthma.
And he had an idea, being a small-time inventor as well. He took a ceiling fan motor and chopped the blades on the ceiling fan way down and put it in a tin box to which he fastened wheels. He used a pillowcase for a dirt bag and a mop handle for a handle to push the contraption across the floor. And it worked.
That's incredible.
I mean, isn't that perfect? If you were imagining the fictitious version of the person who invented the vacuum cleaner, it would be a janitor with asthma, right?
Oh, yeah, that's perfect.
Anyway, so this guy, at some point, he had this very wealthy cousin who ran a successful leather company. And at some point, he took it over to her house and he was like, hey, check out this thing I made. And she really liked the idea. And her name was Susan Hoover.
Hoover. So she just went and marketed it and turned it into a whole thing?
Yeah, door-to-door salesman. It was one of the first appliances that was sold door-to-door. Door-to-door salesmen would bring it into the house. There were stories of, like, rugs that hadn't been cleaned in years, and, like, pounds and pounds of dirt came off of the rugs.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So we've got the history of the invention of vacuum, but that doesn't fully answer your question, because at this point, we're still talking about rugs, right?
Right.
And your question is, which came first, carpets or vacuums? So we don't get wall-to-wall carpeting of the type that is now purple and in your apartment until after World War II. And that industry of cheap carpet started in Northwest Georgia, the state. The way they did is they invented this process of tufting, which meant you could basically produce carpeting faster and cheaper.
Carpets had this association in the public mind with luxury, okay, because they had so long been expensive goods that were associated with comfort.
And then after World War II, there's this huge housing boom, and now everybody can afford carpeting.
So these brand new suburban homes that were built had these beautiful wall-to-wall carpets.
Can I stop? Sorry, there's a vacuum in the background that's rolling right now. I'm just gonna, can we just wait until, okay, sorry.
I'll go. Carpet, tufted carpet was the fourth fastest growing industry in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. Behind aircraft and television picture tubes. It was a huge boom.
And that's how carpet became the ubiquitous flooring of choice.
Wow.
Allison, the wall-to-wall carpeting definitely would not have been possible without the vacuum cleaner. Certainly, it would not have been possible on the scale that we saw it in your home and many other people's homes. It enabled manufacturers to produce wall-to-wall carpeting and to sell it to people. Absolutely.
Yeah. So an asthmatic janitor is the reason that I don't have to get up to a tile on my floor in the morning.
Yes. And the answer to your question, did carpet or the vacuum come first? Like, it's a symbiotic relationship. Rugs begat the vacuum cleaner, which begat wall-to-wall carpet, which you had to have vacuums for. And now we, like, are totally dependent on vacuum cleaners.
Okay. So it was a paradox.
It is a paradox. And this was Randy's advice to you.
Just think, in the old days, if you had a very large rug, you would have had to pick that thing up, drag it out in the backyard, hang it over a clothesline, and beat it with a stick. So just remember, vacuuming compared to that is not so bad.
I think I can get on board with that.
What do you think your roommates will think about this answer?
I think this is probably more information than they ever wanted to know.
If you're ever in St. James, Missouri, and you'd like more information than you ever wanted to know about vacuums, stop by the museum. Tom will give you a free tour. He can turn on vacuums from any era of history.
A
again, one of my favorite vacuums to use in the 1930s section. Now, the first chord rewinder on a vacuum cleaner came in 1933 on the Singer.
Every Little Thing is made by Flora Lichtman, Catherine Wells, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, Christine Driscoll, and Devin Taylor, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Special thanks to Kevin Lee, Rich Halton, and Mark Bramhill. Dara Hirsch scored and mixed this episode. ELT invites you to leave positive feedback on Apple Podcasts, like this review from Kirsty. I cannot. Solid 5 stars. Anything else is a lie. Anything else is a lie. Goodbye.